Unseen Diversity, Lecture 4, A Brief History of Bacteriology, Part 3.
The last lecture was about 17th century microscopy, and we are now jumping ahead to the end of the 19th century. Through the time between microscopes were developed, and by the end of the 19th century, microscopes looked more like the sort of contraption that we consider a microscope today, a tube with lenses on either end and some sort of a lighting system, and very different from what van Leeuwenhoek was looking through in the 17th century. But that wasn't necessarily the most important innovation and the reason that we're jumping to the last part of the 19th century. The most important innovation was the German synthetic dye industry, which was just beginning to become important, and by which many, many new synthetic dyes, versions of what had been dyes from plants and dyes from animals that had been traditionally used to dye cloth, were now being manufactured on a large scale, and slight chemical adjustments were being made such that all sorts of new colors with new chemical properties were being developed, and the Germans were foremost in this. It was a major aspect of the practical part of chemistry. And it turns out that some of these dyes would dye bacteria, would color bacteria. Whoever thought of it first was brilliant. It was a wonderful idea, and it turned out to be much more important maybe than they even anticipated. At first, I think the motivation must have been just to make them a little bit more visible under the microscope. But as I said, the chemistry of dyes was developing along with their use for bacteria, and very often bacteria would respond in very particular ways to particular dyes, such that some aspect of the bacterial activities could actually be deciphered from their reactions to the dyes. So that was a very important new innovation that was occurring. So let me begin this lecture by telling you about the first of four scientists that I will be discussing. First will be Robert Koch, K-O-C-H. Next will be Louis Pasteur, then Christian Graham, and then Sergei Nikolaevich Winogradsky. So first, Robert Koch. He was a German physician of the late 19th century, and he wanted very much to understand the relationship of bacteria with diseases that he was seeing. It was the real beginning of putting bacteria together with pathogenicities, and it was the beginning of a long history of understanding bacteria from the point of view of there being pathogens, or at least some of them being pathogens. And in particular, Koch wanted to establish completely and unequivocally the bacterial connection that was needed at this particular point. At this particular point, that connection had not yet been made. And what developed from Koch's work was something that became known as Koch's postulate, that microbiology students in some classes still memorize. Goes like this. First step of Koch's postulate, get some diseased tissue, like maybe a tissue sample from a patient who has died of pneumonia or tuberculosis, and look for bacteria in that tissue. Look under the microscope for bacteria. And make sure that you find it in all cases of that disease. That is, there should be no diseased tissue that does not have bacteria. That was the first thing that Koch said. So, for example, he was looking for the source of tuberculosis, and he said he needed to find the bacterium called Mycobacterium tuberculosis in all diseased tissues from tubercular patients. And he did. So that was step number one. Step number two, you should be able to isolate that bacteria from tissue and get it growing by itself in the correct nutrients on a petri dish. Okay, so that was the second step. Third step, and here's where he starts to get innovative because the first two steps are perhaps somewhat obvious. Third step, you should be able to take those bacteria off the petri dish and reintroduce them into an experimental animal. You're not going to reintroduce them into a patient, of course, but you should be able to reintroduce them into some appropriate experimental animal, some rodent or something. And that experimental animal should then get whatever the disease was. And then to make absolutely sure, and this gives you a little bit of an idea of what Koch was up against in trying to prove this, to be absolutely sure, step four of Koch's postulate is then you should be able to go into that experimental animal, remove the bacteria, and get them back onto the petri dish. Okay, and then you could be absolutely sure that you had connected bacteria with a particular disease. Maybe it sounds obvious, but at the time it was a major innovation. It was not clear up to that point exactly how some diseases came about, how probably most diseases came about, and certainly there was not a strong connection between bacteria and disease or bacteria as pathogens. Here's what else Koch did, and he did this in conjunction with some of his coworkers, one of which was Walter Hess, and his wife, Angelina Hess. And I'm going to give quite a bit of credit to Walter Hess's wife for this, for reasons that will seem obvious in just a moment. Angelina was not herself working with Koch, but I think this idea came straight from Angelina. And it goes something like this, and it may be something that you have observed yourself. If you have food in the refrigerator that is starting to go bad and is starting to get a little growth of bacteria or fungi or some such microbe on it, and if that food that is starting to get the growth is a sort of a gelatin or jelly or aspic or some other moist surface type food, maybe even the surface of a potato, for example, a cooked potato that is still moist, you might notice that individual colors and slimes grow distinctly as different colonies on that surface. And it's so easy to observe this. It's so obvious that you could observe it and then not take it any further. What happened was that Walter and Angelina Hess observed this and realized that it could be a useful part of a technique for isolating individual bacteria and other microbes. So they took this into the lab and said, what if we were to deliberately set up moist, firm, nutrient-rich surfaces on which we could grow bacteria and other microbes? And it was just a question of what sort of moist surface they would bring into the laboratory. And here were the obvious choices at the time. They could have used pectin, which is a plant material that is used for gelling jams and jellies. And certainly you've probably seen on an old jam or jelly a little bit of fuzz from a mold or a little bit of bacteria. So that's an obvious moist surface on which you could grow some microbes. They could have used gelatin, from which we get gelatin desserts now, which is an animal product. That would be another surface on which you might be able to grow some things. Or they could have used, and in fact did use, agar, which is a seaweed product. Now, it turns out that agar, the seaweed product, was the best of the three, partly because the organisms that they were most interested in isolating could themselves digest and eat and actually liquefy pectin and gelatin. And agar was apparently more foreign to these organisms coming from seaweed, and therefore was a sort of an inert surface, a surface that was not likely to be dissolved and digested and disrupted in any particular way. So you ended up with these bacteria sitting nicely on the surface and growing in these nice discrete colonies that could be distinguished from other colonies, as long as they didn't grow together, as long as you had them far enough apart from each other. And then what you could do is you could make a particular nutrient broth solidify by this, the agar or gelatin or pectin, and you could provide whatever nutrients through the broth to your organisms that you wished. Now, the first obvious thing to try was beef broth. And for many, many years, beef broth was the standard nutrient medium that would be solidified for the purpose of growing organisms. Dilute beef broth or some version of it with extra nutrients added or certain nutrients taken away. And to this day, we have something in the microbiology lab called nutrient agar, which is really nothing much more than a beef broth that can be solidified with agar from seaweed. It really dates right from this particular research at the turn of the 19th century. The next innovation was to do something a little more refined than just simple beef broth, because in fact, beef broth is not especially simple. It's a mixture of hundreds of different chemicals in all different proportions, in slightly different proportions depending on how you prepare it and how old it is, and all different things that make it an undefined medium, a medium that has really got too much going on with it to really understand what's going on. And so the next innovation was something called a defined medium that comes straight from the shelf of the chemistry lab. You go to the chemistry lab and you take a source of protein, measure it out exactly, put that into your mixture. You take a source of calcium, measure it out exactly, put it into your mixture. A defined medium is a list of, sometimes dozens of different things that need to go into a complete nutrient mixture, but you know exactly what went in and in what proportions. So to reiterate that, we've got two kinds of medium, and this is true to this day. You can go into a microbiology lab and sort it out in this particular dichotomy. We have defined medium, which is right off the chemistry stockroom shelf, a list of ingredients precisely measured so we know exactly what's there, and then undefined, which is something like beef broth or something like another mixture that we don't really understand exactly everything that is in there. The benefit of using a defined medium is then you can, in a very precise way, remove things one at a time, each time asking the question, okay, can you grow without calcium? Yes, no. Can you grow without this source of protein? Yes or no. How about if I give you a slightly different source of protein? Can you still grow? Yes or no. So a great many really useful yes or no questions could be asked with a defined medium. Okay, now there's one other component here. So far we've got two components. We've got a brand new surface on which to grow microorganisms. We have the medium, which could be defined or undefined, that the organisms are using as they're growing on the surface. And finally, we have another co-worker of Koch, and that is Julius Richard Petri, inventor of the Petri dish. Okay, that's the third component we need. We want this solid, defined medium on a Petri dish. And I think what was brilliant about Julius Richard Petri's invention was the idea that you don't need much of this. You do not need a great big jar of solidified medium to grow bacteria. All you need is a thin layer in a small dish. And you don't even need to have a tight seal on that dish. You just need to have an easy-to-remove lid for many of the bacteria that they were looking at. And there you have set up in Koch's lab pretty much everything that took us into 20th century microbiology. Pretty much all of the techniques are right there, with one exception that I'll be talking about next. All of the techniques are there for getting bacteria growing in an isolated manner. Now, the other thing that happened that also took us into 20th century microscopy, that also became a major part of any microbiology lab, was the whole technique of using dyes. Many people were using dyes at that time, not just for textiles, but experimenting with dyes for all sorts of things. And many of those were people interested in making biology more visible under the microscope, not just bacteria, but other microorganisms, parts of organisms, tissues. So there was a great sort of alternative use of dyes that were being developed in biology labs at this time. And so when Dr. Hans Christian Gram, who was a Danish physician, set about to experiment with dyes for his own purposes, he probably didn't know that he was doing something really extraordinary, accidentally, I think, with the particular dye that he chose that came to be called Graham stain, and which came to be called the first step for many identifications of bacteria. So here's what Dr. Hans Christian Graham wanted to do. He wanted to do something like what Koch was doing. He wanted to show unequivocally that bacteria could be seen in lung tissue of deceased patients who had died of pneumonia. He wanted to connect bacteria with pneumonia in lung tissue. And it's difficult to see bacteria against a background of lung tissue. The cells of animals are bigger than the cells of bacteria. They're about the same color as the cells of bacteria. It would be extremely difficult to have a tissue sample and be able to distinguish the bacteria in it. So he was adding all sorts of dyes. And one of the dyes that he added was something called crystal violet. It was a synthetic dye that had been developed for the textile industry. And he went through a particular procedure that I would like to go through here with you so that you can get a real feel for what happened and what didn't happen. In a nutshell, some of the bacteria in his lung tissue were able to retain the stain. They were able to become dyed, and some did not. And by the way, when he first noticed that, he was dismayed because he wanted all of them to be dyed. And it wasn't till a little later that he realized that this was a very interesting thing. Some of his bacteria did take up the dye and hold on to it and become stained, and some did not. Some were therefore Graham positive or positive for this dyeing procedure, and some were negative for this dyeing procedure, what we now call Graham positive and Graham negative, because that crystal violet stain is now called Graham stain. Here's what happened. If you were dyeing cloth at home with a dye, you would first prepare the cloth, then you would add the dye, then you might do something to fix the dye in place to make sure that it attached to the fabric correctly, and then you would wash away all the excess dye. So those are some typical steps in any dyeing process. Those are the typical steps that occur in a microbiology lab when we're dyeing bacteria. We get the bacteria prepared to be dyed, then we add the dye itself. Then we add some additional chemicals to make sure that the dye stays in place. And then we wash away all the excess dye. And that washing step is extremely important. Well, here's what happened. Some of the bacteria would take the dye up and hold on to it. For other bacteria, the dye would wash away. And as I said, those are Gram-positive versus Gram-negative bacteria. Big thrill, right? So what? It turns out that Gram-positive bacteria are a major taxonomic group unto themselves on the family tree. If you recall the big family tree of organisms that I described a few lectures back, the huge diversity of all the bacteria, the huge diversity of organisms, most of which are bacteria, one really big branch consists of all of the Gram-positive bacteria. So to this day, that's considered to be a good cohesive taxonomic group of bacteria, essentially discovered by Hans Christian Graham. Now, it turns out that identifying bacteria in a traditional way that occurred all the way through the 20th century was with a dichotomous key, a sort of set of yes or no questions, almost like playing the game 20 questions, where you'd start with, is it an animal or a plant? Is it colored or not colored? Is it active or not active? Well, there were a whole set of questions that were traditionally asked to identify bacteria, and they almost always began with, is it Gram-positive or Gram-negative? So from this one particular observation of Hans Christian Graham came the whole revolution of using dyes as one of the parts of the dichotomous set of questions that would be used for identifying bacteria. That was his contribution. By the way, I am now going to differentiate bacteria and archaea in a way that I said I would do on occasion. Generally, I'm using bacteria in kind of a colloquial way to include the archaea with them, but sometimes I'm going to separate them out. And what I want to say is one of the really strange things about archaea is that they don't Gram stain in any kind of reliable way, so that you don't call archaea either Gram positive or Gram negative. It's one of the things that makes them really very different, and it was a puzzling thing about them until we understood that their DNA is very, very different and that they were essentially evolving along in their own parallel universe. They look superficially like bacteria. They do some things as bacteria do, but they are not in the realm of things that get stained either positively or negatively with anything like Gram stain. They've got their own repertoire of staining characteristics that are really quite different. So there's a good example of a striking difference between those two groups. Now, the third important person from late 19th century into early 20th century microbiology was Louis Pasteur, a French scientist, a French chemist primarily, and he gets an enormous amount of credit for a wide variety of observations that I'll just touch on a bit, one of which was a greater understanding of fermented beverages, in particular wine, but you could extrapolate this out to fermented foods and to other fermented beverages such as beer. And he helped to develop a much firmer understanding of the role of microorganisms in making all sorts of fermented foods and beverages. And here I'm using the word microorganism as an umbrella term for not just bacteria, but also to include microscopic fungi, including yeast. So yeast are not bacteria. They are in the group called the fungi. Their cells are bigger. They're related to mushrooms. They're related to other things that we think of as fungi. But in this whole rubric of the microbial world, they, along with bacteria, are producing various fermented foods. And Pasteur sorted out a great deal of that. The other thing Pasteur did was to begin the whole field of immunology with a growing understanding of vaccinations. And while it's a bit of a digression from this topic of bacteria, and Pasteur was also looking at viruses or what would later be understood as viruses, very often in a traditional study of bacteria, the immune system is a topic in that course. It will be a minor topic in this course, but I want to acknowledge that there's been a long tradition since bacteria were traditionally thought of as being primarily pathogens. There's been a long tradition of thinking about them in relation to how our immune system works with them. So Pasteur's contribution at this time was a greater understanding of our immune system reactions to microbes of all kinds and to viruses, and a greater understanding of how to use vaccines in that context. Meanwhile, in a completely different part of Europe, culturally as well as physically, was a Russian scientist, very interesting person, Sergei Nikolaevich Winogradsky. And he was developing, along with other Russian microbiologists, a really completely different take on microbiology, really a strikingly different paradigm, and one that did not come back together or did not come together at all with Western European microbiology for many years, and to some extent is still considered to be a really separate way of thinking about bacteriology. Let me try this set of dichotomies to differentiate the two. Whereas Robert Koch and his fellow workers were trying to set up bacteria in solitary, isolated colonies on petri dishes, Winogradsky was letting them be all mixed together and nonetheless still understanding things about them. So it's really a very different take. On one hand, we have them growing all by themselves, almost as though they were in solitary confinement and were asked to do just the specific things that they could do by themselves, whereas Winogradsky was saying, let's see what bacteria do when they're interacting with each other in communities. So it's single versus communities. Sergei Nikolaevich Winogradsky's other innovations were to say, let's look at them in their wild format. Let's look at them in something approximating what they would look like in the environment, almost as though we were contrasting two different ways of presenting animals in zoos. You can have animals that are by themselves in cages versus in some sort of wild habitat, he said. Why not put them together in some kind of situation where we can really see what they do in a natural habitat, nonetheless brought into the lab? And I'll actually tell you what that habitat was. It's something that you can reproduce at home if you want to. And finally, the word contamination probably got used quite a bit in Koch's lab, along with Walter Hess and Julius Petri. That is, if you have bacteria that are growing together on a plate and interacting with each other, you say, oh dear, my plate is contaminated. I didn't keep those colonies separate enough. Whereas the word contamination probably didn't exist in Winogradsky's lab. It was just ordinary interactions of the sort that you expect from bacteria. So here's how he set things up. Here's an example of a wild habitat for a mixed group of interacting bacteria. It's called a Winogradsky column. And if I were to set one up at home, I might take a mason jar, a large mason jar, or a large mayonnaise jar, or perhaps the empty plastic tube from tennis balls. And I would take a bit of paper towel, crumble it up and stuff it into the bottom, not very much, maybe a half sheet. That would represent some plant material, because after all, paper towel comes from wood pulp, which ultimately comes from plants. So that would represent some easy to get and fairly neutral form of plant material crumbled in the bottom of my column. I would sprinkle in a little bit of Epsom salts, which can be purchased at the drugstore and which are sometimes used as bath salts. And when I say sprinkle in a bit, maybe a teaspoon or so, and then I would fill the rest of the column with the blackest marine mud that I could find. Or if I were in inland and not able to get to a marine environment, nice black swamp mud would work here. You want something that is going to even be a little bit smelly. And then I would top the whole thing off with a little water. And then I would wrap the entire column with some foil, leaving just a little bit at the top that I would call my photic zone, where the light would be allowed to come in, and the rest of it would be dark beneath the foil. And I would set the whole thing on a windowsill. This is what Winogradsky did. It's called a Winogradsky column. And after a few weeks to months, I might peek under the foil and see what was going on. And if I was lucky, I would be seeing different colors representing different bacteria that were interacting with each other, but also maintaining their own particular part of the habitat that is this column of black mud, which, by the way, is full of bacteria, none of them pathogens. This is perfectly safe on a windowsill. And I will say some more in a subsequent lecture about what sorts of bacteria and interactions can be seen in a Winogradsky column or can be seen in nature. But this was really the beginning of understanding bacteria as major doers out in the environment with major sorts of interactions going on. One of the really amazing things that Winogradsky discovered was a new type of metabolism that was just so exotic that it was not even on anyone's radar of what we might be looking at for metabolisms. Up to that point, metabolisms fell into two categories. What we're doing, we're animals, and we eat food, and that's how we get our energy, and that's how we get materials to build our bodies, versus what plants are doing. They make their own food. They manufacture their own food out of carbon dioxide and water, and I'll describe that more in a subsequent lecture. Winogradsky discovered something completely different from those two called chemoautotrophy. And now is not the place for me to develop that, but I will in a subsequent lecture, so watch for it when I start to talk about different sorts of bacterial metabolisms and how really different and exotic, to our point of view, some of them are. Watch for chemoautotrophy and realize that it was discovered by Winogradsky, not by having the bacteria separate on individual colonies on a petri dish, but by putting them together in a Winogradsky column as he did. After the Russian Revolution of 1917, Winogradsky went into exile to Paris and ended up at the Institut Pasteur. So there's a little connection between Pasteur and Winogradsky after the Russian Revolution. By the way, I can suggest some things to read about this, two in particular that have been a great influence on generations of microbiologists, great influence on me and many microbiologists that I know. One is called The Microbe Hunters by Paul de Kruijf. And this is an absolutely passionate book on the subject of microbiology. And you can read biographies of Van Leeuwenhoek, of Koch, of Pasteur, of Graham. He doesn't say much about Winogradsky because this is mostly about Western microbiology. One thing I notice about this book that you might enjoy too is his repeated, Paul de Kruijf's repeated use of the word gorgeous when describing the sites under the microscope. So this is not just an ordinary objective study of the development of microbiology. It's an absolutely passionate study of the development of microbiology and well worth reading and really inspiring. And right around the same time that that book was being written, The Microbe Hunters, Sinclair Lewis was writing Arrowsmith, which is a novel in which was very much influenced by what was going on in microbiology at the time, and which is a wonderful story, also very influential, of the politics and ethics and emotions that are associated with microbiology. Well worth reading. And in fact, Sinclair Lewis said later that he owed a great debt to Paul de Kruijf for getting together all the information that Sinclair Lewis needed to put together his novel Arrowsmith. And by the way, the last thing I want to do here before going on to the next lecture is to reiterate briefly what is microbiology versus what is bacteriology. And again, I think it's a problem that the terminology has not kept pace with the science. We're stuck with a lot of terminology that was developed at a time when things were being lumped together into categories that we don't use so much anymore. So the overall term microbiology refers to not only the bacteria and the archaea, but also to the microscopic fungi and sometimes to the protozoans like paramecium and amoeba. And sometimes in a course that calls itself microbiology, there will be included viruses, which are really a very completely different entity that I'll be talking about briefly later. And there'll be also some mention of the immune system and its reactions to all of these. So microbiology is really a big catch-all topic, and the word microbe is really a very general big catch-all term. I'm going to now narrow things down to just talking about bacteria as encompassing the bacteria and archaea that I've been alluding to. And I'm not going to say much more about the bigger overarching field of microbiology, even though through the early part of the 19th century, the late part of the 19th century and the early 20th century, that's what was being developed. There wasn't as great a differentiation being made between one group of microbes versus another. These people that I've just been talking about were looking at the microbes as a whole. It was an amazing thing to be doing at all. And so that was the overarching focus. In the next lecture, I want to examine the family tree of bacteria a little more closely and to put into more perspective what happened over 4 billion years of evolution and where bacteria and archaea fit in to the family tree of life, And from there, I will talk about the deepest lineages of bacteria and archaea, which are called the extremophiles, and which include some that you should be able to observe yourself using particular field marks that I will describe to you.
This ends Lecture 4. Remember to visit this course's webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll find additional information about the lectures you just heard. Once there, you can access this course by using the password 1121BDD. Again, that's 1121BDD.